London is a city where people come to make money. Its basis as a trade centre and a financial centre, as well as it being a place of employment and specialist jobs, are not new things. In fact, it has been, as I hope the previous 106 chapters have shown, something that has always been linked to London. But with all the issues that have been happening of late in the story of the city, what with the wars and the diplomatic issues we've been covering over the last few chapters, I feel the state of the economy of London at the end of the 13th century and start of the 14th century must be examined in detail. Now, I can sense some of you already bracing yourselves. Wait, is this guy going to speak about 13th century economics? Oh God, run! No, wait, don't go, please, don't go, just hang on. See, economics then and now has impacts upon people. This chapter is about economics, sure, but how the economics of the late 13th century physically changed the streets of London, how they changed London's relationships with its neighbours, how it changed London's relationship with its own merchants. It's about the rise of one of London's lost streets, a place that was to flourish and to become a known location in the city, as famous as Cheapside or Cornhill and Fleet Street, but which is entirely lost to us now. This is about the story of Soper's Lane. This episode also looks at how, even back in the 13th century, London was part of Europe, how foreign money flooded the city, and how foreign businessmen found London a place they could not just make money in, but how easy it was for them to move here, settle down, and become Londoners. And it's about how business can make groups of Londoners rivals, and how the need to make money and run the city can make these rivals become allies. Hi there, my name is Saul and you are listening to The Story of London, an attempt to try and explain the history of the city as a single long narrative tale. So far we've made it only as far as the year 1300 and have taken 107 chapters to get here. And the story I tried to tell also tries to balance the need for as much historical detail as possible with the need to just tell a cracking tale, one I hope you find interesting. And what follows is a tale, a story, and while this one is heavy on the detail, I hope it's still an entertaining one, The Rise of Soper's Lane. So, back at the end of the 13th century, after 13 years of direct government by royal wardens, London regained its independence and got its mayor back, which came into effect fully in the year 1299, as we covered last chapter. As we said back then, it was not the united pressure of the citizens of London that wrung this concession from the king, but rather a political storm caused by opposition of the barons in Parliament to the taxes and military service demanded of them by the king for his wars going on in France and Scotland. The combination of military failures and a desperate shortage of cash forced King Edward I to bend before the political storm going on around him, and he judged it to be rather prudent to lift his iron fist from London and to seek an alliance with the people who ran the city. The aldermen of London were happy to exploit this, but they were aware of the fragility of their independence. What could be taken so easily before could be taken easily again. They had discreetly chosen as mayor Henry de Wallis, the trusted former servant of the king. They'd learned a lesson over those years when the wardens had been in charge, that even when he was weak, it was better to be an ally of this king than an enemy. But fundamentally, when London regained its mayoralty, London's economy had changed, and changed drastically. But this change was part of a much bigger change that had taken place over the last 30 years. And understanding how it had changed also gives you an interesting insight into life in the city. You see, comprehensive studies by the excellent historian DJ Keen of the population, buildings and rents on Cheapside have concluded that the late 13th century and early 14th centuries were the period when the demand for shops and the density of population in that area were greater than at any other time before the beginning of the 17th century. There was a huge property boom and business boom in Cheapside. And this boom in the need of shops caused there to be an expansion of the merchants of Cheapside southwards into a row of buildings described as Novo Vicus or New Street in 1218. At the same time as this expansion south, other merchants began to outgrow their quarters in Watling Street and began to move northwards along this same road, which by 1251 was referred to as Shopurer's Lane. Over the next few years, Shopurer's Lane became known as Sopurer's Lane, and then finally, Soper's Lane. So before we go any further, we've got to take on board that this is a place called Soper's Lane, and it was born out of a great expansion in the trade of the City of London that forced shopkeepers to expand into it, desperate for space. And we know that this expansion in London's economy was going on because you see it reflected in things like new quays being built down by the Tower of London, in the growth in the population of Westminster and the suburb of Aldgate, and in nothing more than the city's decision in 1274 and 5 to start registering the names of apprentices to try and regulate this sheer volume of people who were claiming to be apprentices so to qualify for freedom of the city later on. In other words, there was a population boom as well as an economic boom going on. Now, this growth, this explosion in the economy, is usually connected to the reforms in London that had taken place, both political and economic, when Edward I had ruled it directly via the wardens since 1285. But the seeds of it had actually started 15 years earlier. The immediate cause of the expansion of London's merchants came about in 1270, in events we covered back in chapter 100, when all the Flemish merchants in England were arrested with their goods, and for the next 5 years they were unable to return to England to trade due to a fallout with the Duchess of the Flemings and the English King. The situation actually dragged on for quite some time in a limbo state of, well, it's been worked on, and it was not finally resolved until 1287. But the result of this was that the Flemish domination of the wool trade in England was shattered, and they never recovered from the power they'd had over the trade, and by the end of the 13th century, they'd ceased to travel in any numbers to England. Business, like nature, abhors a vacuum. So with the Flemish losing control of the English wool trade, there was now a chance for English merchants to jump in and take over. And some English did. But those gains were small compared to those made by the Italians and the Hanseatic merchants of northern Germany. One reason that the English merchants could not compete with these foreigners was, simply put, they were banned from trading directly with Flanders, which meant that the English could not export wool directly to them, but had to take it via the nearby town of St. Omer, and they were making a lion's share of the cut there. The Germanic Hansards, by contrast, became the formal intermediaries for the Flemings. But the reason why the Italians were able to seize about a quarter of the wool trade for themselves in the 1270s was they had the capital needed to take over from the Flemings the large-scale contracts with the Cistercian abbeys up north, who were England's chief suppliers of wool and were accustomed to expect payment in advance. And this basically meant that the Italians began to get involved in London. And the Italians getting more involved in London is something we need to look at, as they really change things up in the city in two significant ways. So let's just look at the first way, and do not worry, this will all lead to the explosion of shops in Soper's Lane. The Italians, as we've covered in previous chapters, had been conspicuous financiers of the English crown. For three generations, Italian finances' ability to access easy credit had made them crucial to the English government. Their principal motivation, however, in lending to the crown was simply to obtain privileges and safeguards for their trade. And like the Flemish, whose imports back into England of cloth found a wide market everywhere, the Italians tended to import high-value goods, such as luxury cloths embroidered with gold and silver, expensive wines, and above all, raw jewels. These only found a steady market in London, where they were sold to the court and the nobles of the country. Now, while some of their working capital of this era they gained for collecting monies on behalf of the papacy, most of their cash these Italians had, they had accumulated from trade in these luxury goods. Now, while the Flemings could distribute their own goods through the fairs by sailing back and forth across the North Sea and returning each trading season, the Italians couldn't do that, and they needed a permanent base for their financial and commercial operations in England. And they therefore sought the king's protection and license to stay in London. And they needed the king's license, as this was the only way they could circumnavigate London's rules, which officially said foreign merchants could only stay for 40 days and included regulations which were designed to stop them from engaging in the retail and distribution trade. These Italians wanted permanent quarters in the city where they could conduct their business instead of being obliged to live in hostels which were under the control of Londoners. And they also needed protection of English law to secure their loans and to pursue their debtors. As early as 1257, some of these Italians had already built for themselves costly houses in London. And although they still suffered from immediately being expelled from the kingdom because they were usurers, they had the money to purchase the king's permission to return. A prominent Florentine merchant, Dutatus, was granted by Henry III in 1252 the right to live and trade as a citizen of London, and he built for himself a huge house in the city, costing hundreds of marks to build. So with this in mind, consider that the events of the 1270s, which opened to the Italians a major share in the wool trade, brought to the fore new companies whose names came to symbolise the power of Italian high finance, the Riccardi, the Frescobaldi, and eventually the Bardi. It was their imports into London of silk and gold embroidered cloths, velvets and damasks, which accounted for their dominance of foreign imports into London at the beginning of the 14th century. They were making a lot of money selling luxury goods in London. And proof of this is their huge loans to the crown, secured by the revenues from wool customs, and these financed the wars of Edward I and are evidence of the capital they were able to invest in English trade. The actual wealth which made Edward I's conquest possible was ultimately generated by English taxpayers, and it was only managed by the Italians as the agents of the crown. Their actual loans to Edward were not financed by coins being exported from Italy, but were the invested profits of their northern trade. And they could make large profits in England because of the wealth which flowed into the country in the 13th century from the export of wool cloth and the products of a varied and strong economy. And it was this wealth which gave the nobility the means to purchase the goods the Italians are selling. Now, some have suggested the Italians introduced banking to England, but as we covered all the way back in chapter 90, sophisticated systems of banking and credit have been witnessed in London since the 1240s. Where the Italians streamlined things and did contribute to further economic growth was their ability to move sums of money from one country to another via bills of exchange. For some historians, the changes which Italian merchants introduced into European patterns of trade in the last two or three decades of this century have been described as a commercial revolution, because they replaced the image of the traditional travelling merchant who sold his own goods at fairs with the image of firms which conducted their business through correspondence with agents in the main cities and ports of Europe. But such developments in commercial practice grew out of new business opportunities, rather than the other way round. The withdrawal of the Flemish enabled the Italians to increase their involvement in the wool trade, and by this means to tie the economies of northern and southern Europe together. Their increased exports of wool directly to Italy created the need for settled merchants able to correspond with and to arrange finance for markets so far apart. At the same time, the Italians' ability to draw on credits over a trading network extending from the Mediterranean to the North Sea was immeasurably increased as a result of an increased supply of money in the second half of the 13th century, and of the greater exchange of goods that such monetary expansion made possible. And it thereby increased English mercantile capital. And this goes back to explain why we had a property boom in Cheapside. The Italians, in order to protect their trading privileges, were more likely than the English to venture into the risky business of advancing large sums of cash to the crown. And they appear in records of debt at the end of the 13th century also as lending individually the greatest sums to English knights and monasteries, presumably for the purchase of wool. But around the same time, the great majority of loans for commercial and other purposes are being made by Englishmen. Still, the Italians are now a thing, and they were a thing because they could capitalise on the fall of the Flemish in dominating the English wool trade. The Italian success in seizing most of the Flemish share of the wool did not immediately involve them having a close relationship with London merchants. The Italians were exporting most of their wool using Flemish or Dutch shipping through the ports of Hull and Boston, which were the closest to the big monastic suppliers up north. Moreover, the companies which came to England in the 1270s to take part in the wool trade were mostly from Florence, Lucca or Siena. They were not involved in this period in the spice trade with the Levant in Egypt, which was dominated by the maritime cities of Genoa and Venice. The Genoese and Venetians continued to sell spices mostly in either northern France, southern France, or Bruges, and they were content to let the Flemish or the southern French then export the spice to England. The Genoese and Venetians found little in England they could export to make it worth extending their trade beyond Bruges. The struggling English cloth industry could not compete with the demands of the Flemish for alum, woad and other dyes, which the Venetians and the Genoese sold in bulk in Bruges. All right, we'll come back to the Italians. We need to stick a pin in them. And we need to talk about the Germans. And the reason we need to talk about the Germans is because the largest and most immediate consequence for London merchants and the dealers in luxury imports of the departure of the Flemings in the 1270s involved not Italian, but Germanic Hanseatic trade. And specifically, this led to a new rivalry within London. Two groups of merchants ended up finding themselves as rivals and occasionally at loggerheads. On the one hand, you had London's traditional mercers or pepperers. And suddenly, arising out of nowhere, came the rope makers or ropers of London. Why did this happen? Well, this is because the Hanseatic merchants from the Rhineland and the Baltic became intermediaries for the Flemings and largely took over their trade in cloth in England. The Baltic towns, such as Hamburg and Lübeck, had formed their own Hanses or trading associations in the 13th century as they built up their maritime trade. And they exported to Bruges and now to England wax, furs, honey, timber, potash, iron, canvas, and rope, the products of their northern region. By carrying these to England for sale, they could hope to take over in return a greater share of English wool exports back to Flanders. Now, the Hanseds were greatly assisted in their ambition by the privileges they had acquired in England, which were of a kind possessed by no other foreigner. These allowed them to trade on equal terms with the citizens of London, both in the city and throughout the kingdom, where they were able to trade free of toll. They were also granted their own guild hall down at Dowgate, the Steelyard. The Hansards, therefore, had no need to seek protection from the crown. The retail market of London was open to them, and they could use London as a base to penetrate the provincial markets. At their headquarters in the steelyard, the Germanic merchants lived a disciplined corporate life under their own aldermen. The steelyard was both a warehouse and a fortress, and had that very London trait of being aggressive in asserting their privileges. The Flemings' departure gave the Hansards the opportunity to increase their exports, and a document of the early 1270s showed that 42 of them were in the steelyard and exporting wool from London. And because they were making more money from their exports, these Germans now began to increase their imports into London. And we began to see their much increased tension over the import and selling of wax. Why? The royal wardrobe was the biggest single market for wax. And if the Hansards captured it by importing their wax from the Baltic into the port of London, the existing London pepperers would be denied any significant outlet for the wax they were importing from Spain. The Londoners claimed in 1298 that the Hans was illegally avoiding customs on their imports into London, since their privileges covered only imports from Germany. And technically they were importing goods from Flanders, but the Hansards, though, found support from the king and were clearly going to exploit every political advantage to increase their trade. And that included gaining allies within London's merchant community to counter these complaining Londoners. Within London, you see, the chief beneficiaries of all these Hanseatic imports, and therefore the potential trading rivals of the existing merchants, were the rope makers, who lived predominantly in two parishes, the parish of All Hallows the Great and All Hallows the Less, the area next to Dowgate, which was known as the ropery. Originally, rope making was a manufacturing craft, making rope and canvas from raw materials imported by the merchants in the steelyard. The expansion of the wool trade increased the demand for the canvas sarples in which the wool was packed and for the cords which secured them. And so it's natural that the retailers who supplied these Germans should become involved then in wool exports. And a mercantile group emerged from within their ranks, which set its sights on going beyond just retail trade. Acting originally as middlemen for the Hansards, they helped, after the departure of the Flemings, to take over some of the distributive trade in Flemish and Hanseatic goods, which had previously been organised in England's fairs. And at the same time, they also began their involvement in the wool trade, firstly to supply the Hansards, and then to export it on their own account. One rope maker, Thomas Box, in 1265, was importing corn and other goods to London from Ipswich, which he also invested heavily into London property. Box was elected sheriff in 1279 and became an alderman in 1285. His impressive house next to the steelyard stretched from Thames Street to the river, and he possessed other houses and even owned a wharf. The Box family had several branches. They were all connected with the ropery and increasingly with the wool trade. Hammo and William Box were amongst those licensed to export wool in 1271, and William exported 100 sacks 2 years later. By 1292, Hammo Box was a sheriff of London and one of the highest taxpayers in Dowgate Ward. He was also able to leave his children extensive property across the ropery and other parishes. Other families of ropers prospered in the same way. Peter Cosin, who exported 20 sacks of wool in 1273 and 60 only 4 years later, had a wharf and property between Dowgate Dock and the lane which bears his family name, today's Cousins Lane. He built up an extensive trade in corn and wine as well as wool. On his death in 1292, he left rents in Dowgate to endow the chantry of All Hallows the Great, and his property elsewhere in London and in Boston was divided between his three sons, who continued the family business. Robert de Meurs is another rope maker licensed to export wool in 1273, and his family also continued to be prominent in the ropery after his death. The most powerful dynasty of London ropers were the Rookseleys. These were a particularly large clan related to Sir Gregory de Rookseley. Now, regular listeners may well remember Gregory de Rookseley. He'd been an alderman for Dowgate for 26 years from 1285. He'd been the King's Chamberlain of London in the 1270s. He'd run the new Royal Mint behind the walls of the Tower of London for the Crown. and he'd been mayor of London 8 times. Gregory being the mayor who'd been in charge when London had seen a legal pogrom which murdered hundreds of Jews for coin clipping, and it had been Gregory who was mayor when he had misjudged the mood of John de Kirby, the Bishop of Ely, and had seen the loss of the position of mayor on his watch. Yeah, that guy. Now, I described Gregory back then as a giant in London political circles, and they also explained that he was a goldsmith, and he did indeed become a goldsmith. But he didn't start that way. And it appears that he and his family had roots in rope making. We know Gregory already had manors in Kent before he moved to London and began selling wax and spices to the royal household, probably supplied from the Germans down in the steelyard. And by 1273, Gregory was able to export 110 sacks of wool and embarked on various enterprises in wine, corn, and investments in city property. Now, on his death, he left a chantry in All Hallows the Great and his own property in that parish to his nephew Roger, a roper. And he was a son of Gregory's brother, John, also a roper. And the reason why he left him that property is because Gregory didn't have any direct male heirs. And it's almost certain as well that it was his brother, John the rope maker, who ended up being appointed as a broker for Woad. And that's also significant because there's the proof of the relationship between the steelyard and the ropers of ropery. So when the war broke out with the French, as we talked about last chapter, this diverted much of the import of Woad into London into the hands of the Germans in the steelyard. And since the centre of London's Woad trade was in Candlewick Street, which was not far from the ropery, and the ropers were well placed as trading partners of the Germans in the steelyard, they could then take over its distribution. And that's why his brother John was made a broker of Woad. And another brother called Robert also achieved the distinction as an alderman of Lime Street. And several more Rooksleys appear in the last 3 decades of the 13th century as ropers, and also as owners of wharfs, shops, and houses in the ropery. So coming back to now in the 1270s and 80s, when we've got 2 Rooksleys and Thomas Box named as aldermen, and Germanic exports of wool from London to Flanders were helping to draw trade away from the fairs of England into London, the likelihood was that the ropers of Dowgate, rather than the pepperers and merchants of Cheapside, were becoming richer and potentially gaining more political power as a result. And you know what? You see it kind of around about the 1290s, when 2 ropers, William Cosin and John Attergate, attained the position of royal agents in Antwerp, when the king directed English wool to be exported to Holland and Brabant instead of Flanders. And this goes a way to explain why Soper's Lane became so popular with the mercers and pepperers who were living up in Cheapside. The tax records of 1292 show that some important pepperers had already begun moving to the ropers' trading quarter down in Dowgate, presumably so that they could buy and store more easily the imports of the German merchants and wool for export. It's significant that the city's early wool market up at St. Mary Wool Church near Cheapside had closed in 1274, presumably because it had ceased to meet the needs of London's increased export trade of wool. William de Hereford, the only pepper who is recorded in this period as dealing in wool at the fairs, bought property in the parish of All Hallows the Great, where his mansion, Cold Harbour, became famous later on. Another pepperer, William de Leon, who also imported iron, also lived in Dowgate, where he and the roper, Hammer Box, were the 2 highest taxpayers. And while it's easy to see the ropers as getting rich because of their friends the Germans, and it's giving them an advantage, the mercers and the pepperers also had their own foreign ties, which kind of gave them an advantage, at least at first, because they were tied to the French merchants, the Corazins. And just as the Germans were the chief trading partners of the ropers in Dowgate, so the Corazins, led by someone called William Savant, dominated the pepperers trade in the Cordwainer Ward in the 1270s. Even when the Italians greatly increased their share of wool exports after the expulsion of the Flemish, they continued to leave the import trade in spices to the Khorasins, and this arrangement lasted for over 20 years. William Savat had traded with London spices since at least 1250. He was a chief in a group of Khorasins who took over and developed in the 1270s wide commercial connections, including with those in the royal household, which had already been forged by the likes of Pontius Mora, who I mentioned back, I think, in chapter 90. As with them, Savat's chief interest was in exporting wool, which he bought on long-term contracts from English abbeys and exported sometimes in his own ships, to pay for his purchases of wool. Savant imported expensive wines from Gascony and spices and silks through Provence. By 1294, he was employed as a royal agent, and 6 years later, he was one of the principal suppliers of wax and spices to the royal household. Until 1292, Savant traded in England under the protection of royal safe conduct. But in that year, he became a citizen and ran his own hostel for his compatriots in Cordwainer Street. In 1303, Savant was appointed a collector of customs in the port of London. In 1309, Savant represented the city in Parliament, and he was to become an alderman. He remained until his death in 1318, a conspicuous example of foreign advancement into the heart of London's mercantile elite. Indeed, London was showing a unique distinction it had shown in its past, but which had been missing kind of lately. London was showing that while it was protective of the rights of Londoners, it could still happily accept newcomers into the city from the rest of England and abroad and make them Londoners. The rising men who dominated the spice trade in the 1270s had no dynastic link with any of the families of London a generation before, even if many of these rising men became aldermen. As well as that, while there were anti-foreigner riots like in 1262 where Jews and Khorasins were attacked and robbed, foreigners active in the spice trade could normally expect, even before Edward's intervention, to be admitted without great difficulty to become citizens and have the right to trade in London on equal terms, provided, you know, they paid their full share of the city's taxes. Let's face it, in the 1260s, it was the very success of foreigners and their conspicuous property boom in London which made them the targets for the rioters. But from a London point of view, you want to pay your fair share of taxes? Welcome to London. Sure, some seem to have gotten the position of citizen of London only because they had links to the crown. The Montpellier family, as their position of royal apothecaries, eased things for them there. And that Italian I mentioned before, Dictatus of Florence, seemed to have been imposed on the city. But still, there will emerge a whole bunch of people who had come to London in from abroad and who not only made money, they settled and became part of London's great and good. Members of the Arras and Amiens families of Soper's Lane must have acquired citizenship in the 12th or 13th centuries. Philip de Bruges gained two shops in Cordwainer Street in the reign of Henry III, and he almost certainly came from Flanders. The mercer, William Bruthini, whose son Richard was to be a prominent pepperer, was also a recent immigrant from France. Florentines began acquiring leasehold property in the 1270s, and Ralph Adrian had let property to some merchants from Lucca sometime before his death in 1286. The Khorasin, Arnold Griffin, who was a prominent wool exporter, was a citizen of London before 1271, as was a merchant from Lübeck, John de Brilond. Hugh Montuan, the Soper's Lane pepperer, who became the city's chamberlain in 1270, was most likely the son of a Khorasin merchant who had settled in London. And by 1270, he owned an extensive block of property fronting onto Cordwainer Street, just south of Watling Street. The most successful dealer in peppers and spices of apparently foreign descent, who became a citizen before 1285, was a man called Thomas Romaine. Now, I say apparently, London records in 1305 say there was a citizen of the Italian city of Lucca who was called Romaine, but we're not 100% sure if this Romaine of Lucca was Thomas Romaine. But if he was born in Lucca, he'd become a giant in London. In the 1280s, he was supplying spices to Westminster Abbey. He was established in London before then, and he also bought a shop in Soper's Lane next to Hugh Montour's, and was then described as a citizen and pepperer. He invested in London property steadily in the 80s and 90s. His main residence was in the parish of St. Mary Aldermany, where he ran a hostel for foreign merchants and built a chapel dedicated to St. Thomas in the parish church. By 1291, he was serving as a sheriff with another pepperer, Willem de Leyer, and the following year he was one of the top taxpayers in the city. He became an alderman 2 years later, and he became mayor in 1309. There is no evidence that Romaine's great riches were acquired in the import or export trades or in supplying the court, and it's more probable that, like his neighbour, Hugh Montuan, he was a son of an earlier immigrant to London, and that he made his profits in the retail and distributive trade. Thomas Romaine's rise to the mayoralty and Hugh Montuan's to the chamberlainship of London therefore reveal two aspects of late 13th century city life which really stand out. One is the comparative openness of London society, even before 1285, and the relative ease which a foreigner, as well as a provincial migrant, could acquire property, could buy their way into freedom of the city by redemption, and could then go on to become alderman and even mayor. And the second is that the 1280s and 1290s show no sudden demotion of established trades or families from the ruling class of London as a consequence of the government by royal wardens. The Blunds of Soper's Lane, for example, produced Sir John Blund, a mayor who was elected six times between 1301 and 1308. And the entire trade of pepperers, instead of declining, began to grow. And you can see that in the number of pepperers and spices who appear in London's record. They expand visibly from a mere handful who were recorded in the 1260s to 23 in the 1270s, 29 in the 1280s, and to 54 in the 1290s. Few of them were foreign origin. At least half appeared to be migrants from the provinces. The importance and the significance of this growth in pepperers can be assessed by the fact that Paris, which is thought to have a population of at least double, if not more, than the population of London, had in 1292 28 spices and apothecaries and even seven merchants called pepperers, making a grand total of 35 men involved in the spice trade. Compare that to London's 54. The appearance of new aldermen amongst the pepperers also indicate a growth in wealth in existing London businesses. William de Maeslina was elected as an alderman in 1283. William de Hereford was elected in 1289. John de Canterbury in 1291. Thomas Romaine in 1294. William de Shortford had a tax assessment of £5 in 1292, as high as Thomas Romaine's. And he was elected sheriff in 1297. And William de Leyer, who had an assessment of £4, was elected alderman in 1298. In spite of his ascendancy in the royal market, William Savant's assessment was only 10 shillings less than John de Burford's. Two other pepperers had assessments of tax of around 40 shillings, and Richard de Montpellier, the royal apothecary, was assessed at 20 shillings. But we must say, of the 29 pepperers and apothecaries known to be active in the 1280s, a number of which rose to 54, only 14 paid any tax in 1292. Although they were rapidly growing in numbers and some had acquired considerable wealth, the majority of them in 1292 were still of fairly modest means. From 1280, the hustings rolls show that the pepperers were beginning to acquire shop after shop in Soper's Lane, in a property boom that clearly reflected the expansion of their trade. By the end of that decade, the royal wardrobe took it for granted that Soper's Lane was the pepperers' trading quarter. In the 1280s, the mercers also began to advance southwards into Soper's Lane from their trading quarter in Cheapside. Some of those who acquired houses and shops there were the likes of William de Garton and Robert de Cully, who were buying valuable imports from the Coracins, while William de Garton also opened up in Soper's Lane a hostel for foreign merchants. Several such hostels in which Coracin merchants were staying were listed that year. Five of them were run by pepperers, and it's clear that Soper's Lane had become one of the chief quarters where alien importers stayed and sold their wares. Despite the narrow frontages of these shops, which faced each other across the confined space of Soper's Lane, they were built with massive cellars, large enough to store bales of spices and wax and other goods imported by Corsicans and Italians. The cellar, which the pepperer Robert de Cleve acquired in 1280 with his tenement in Soper's Lane, measured just over 90 feet by 71 feet. The tenement, which William de Hewelton rented in 1291 in Soper's Lane, cost him 9 shillings a year and 4 ounces of pepper, and had a frontage of only 8 feet, but it was 60 feet long. The size and space given to storage that these shops and cellars had tell us that they were built for more than just walk-in local retail trade. The Corsicans and the Italians had always made London their chief entrepot, partly because it was nearest to the Channel ports, and also because it offered them the best market for luxury imports. But even after they'd been granted their new privileges in 1285, there is little evidence that the Italians or Corsicans used them to set up a distribution system from London to the regional fairs. As the records of their credit show, they were interested mostly in large-scale contracts and neither the time nor the inclination to spend weeks standing in booths at provincial fairs selling their goods. What they wanted was to safeguard the rights of citizenship, which enabled to increase their sales to the royal household and the rich abbeys, which provided them with their wool. It was far more profitable to sell the rest of the imports on credit to London pepperers, just as the Germans were doing in supplying the ropers. What drew the pepperers to the fairs was the chance they saw both to expand their own retail and distribution trade in spices and also take over from Flemings the purchase of much of the wool which was sold there by smaller growers. By entering the wool trade as middlemen and buying up wool at the fairs, which they then carried to London and sold to the Italians and Corsicans, the pepperers were then able to pay for the spices which they bought from them on credit. Given all of this, it's not surprising, therefore, that the dominant impression of the pepperers and spices of Soper's Lane and Cheapside, who were active in the last 3 decades of the 13th century, was one of changing groups of merchants and shopkeepers constantly replenished by immigrants. Immigration was necessary merely to keep up the numbers, let alone permit growth. And why was it required? Because let's face it, even before the soon-to-arrive visit of the plague, and a heads up, the Great Plague is on its way, it's likely that there were high rates of both infant and adult mortality from the diseases associated with poor and non-existent sanitation. Sewage ran through open drains. Butcher's offal and noxious product of industries such as tanning were left to lie in public places and block the watercourses. As we know, pigs and other livestock wandered the streets. The mayor and aldermen struggled to enforce minimum standards for cleanliness, but the constant repetition of edicts against these nuisances shows that theirs was an uphill, if not impossible, task. In Dowgate, the pepperer and alderman John de Grantham and the roper William Cosin had built their houses on either side of Grantham's Lane with overhanging latrines, the contents of which might be discharged in anyone foolish enough to be passing underneath. Immigration from the provinces, therefore, must always have been a necessary condition of life in London. But it is unfortunate that the records do not exist, which would permit a calculation of how important it was before the 1270s, when everything points to an acceleration in the number of those who sought their fortune in the city. About half of the pepperers active in each of the last 3 decades of the 13th century bore surnames which suggested they were immigrants from the provinces. And this really came to a head in the 1290s, where there was a wave of immigrants into London from East Anglia and the East Midlands, which altered the character of the population and even the speech of the city. Quite clearly, the immigration from East Anglia was partly the consequence of Londoners returning to the fairs of Boston and St. Ives as middlemen for the Corsicans and Italians. They made contact with local merchants to whom they sold their imports and from whom they bought the wool in return. Records of these pepperers' credit show them dealing with customers from Ipswich to Spalding to Rutland and Yorkshire. But more changes in London were needed before men from these areas would have had the incentive to leave their rural homes and become migrants to the city. The jump in the pepperers' numbers from the 28 recorded in the 1280s to the 52 in the 1290s suggests that a major change took place in the last decade, basically made the wool trade cease to be tied to the port of Boston in the north, and in fact it moved to the south. And this meant that the chief motor of economic growth moved to the city and brought with it merchants, apprentices and customers. So we have to ask, why did it move to London? Well, the king was intent on using the wool trade as a financial and diplomatic weapon, and as we covered, the order was given to seize all the wool in the realm so he could sell it on. Now, in the next 3 years, the amount of English wool exported was halved, as both the French and Flemish markets were closed to England, and the Corassins had their goods confiscated and were unable to export. It was to prove a final blow to their already waning share of the wool trade. Moreover, the activities of Flemish pirates in the North Sea made exporting from Boston and the other eastern ports too dangerous. The consequence was that the Italian firms began to use London as their chief wool export. In 1297, a galley was loaded with 249 sacks of wool in London. This event marked London's true victory over its main sea rival, Boston. But that war with France didn't just screw with the port of Boston, it also allowed the Italians to change London a second time. And this time, the change came because of the spice trade. The war with France sapped the trade to southern France, where spices were coming in from. Similarly, the war interfered with imports of woad from Picardy to the eastern ports. By encouraging the Italians to export from London instead of from the southeast ports, the war finally brought about the conjunction of the spice trade, the dye trade and the wool trade. It made it commercially feasible the sea route from Italy to England in the galleys of the Genoese. And this was to have a profound effect on London's trade and brought Genoa to London. Well, it wasn't that the war with France made it profitable for the Genoese merchants to come to London. It's more that the war allowed the Genoese to capitalize on something that they'd started 30 years earlier. You see, in the 1260s, the Genoese gained control of the two most important sources of alum for the European cloth industry. Alum had a high value as well as a bulk, which justified its transport by galley. If the Genoese could be sure of finding an equally bulky and valuable cargo in return, they could afford to send a ship to London. In 1278, Bernetto Zaccari, the owner of an alum mine, sent a cargo of alum in the first galleys known to have reached England from the Mediterranean. 3 years later, two Genoese and a Majorcan were rowed out of the port of London, laden with wool. Now, these Genoese voyages to and from London were known to be somewhat speculative and erratic for at least 20 years. Every one of them was a product of individual enterprise with no regular pattern or organisation behind it. The development of a direct sea route was also inhibited by piracy and war at sea, which raised the cost of protecting merchant ships. It was not until the war against the French and the activities of pirates, which made shipping hazardous in the North Sea, that the Italian companies began to abandon the land route through Flanders in favour of the Port of London and the sea route to Italy. Only then did the Genoese begin to make their presence felt as trading partners and rivals of the Pepperers. As a consequence of the growth of Italian trade in London, the Crown and nobility began to acquire buildings which they could store their luxury items in for use in their courts, huge warehouses and factories known as wardrobes. And the earliest waves of wardrobes in London appear in or close to Cheapside during the years in and around 1300. Many of these buildings were previously occupied by Italians, and acquiring them, the king and nobility were able to store the increasing quality of luxury goods which they were purchasing from these Italians in the city. The Italians had obtained in London by 1300 what they needed the most: a single market capable of absorbing their luxury cloth, their spices and their alum in sufficient quantities to finance the wool purchasers, and capable also of supplying them with cargoes of wool in return. The combined import and export trades of high value made possible a regular transport system by galley. Even so, it wasn't until 1312 that they succeeded in building galleys capable of carrying 150 tons of merchandise, which could be worked by a crew of 150. When that happened, land routes could not compete with transport by the sea. But this achievement was only possible because the London Pepperers had succeeded from the 1270s in taking over from the Flemings the supply of Mediterranean and Iberian imports to the provincial fairs, and were able from the 1290s to supply the Italians with much of the wool they needed to export from London. The response of the Pepperers to opportunities of business created by the withdrawal of the Flemings had helped make London once again the centre of distributive trade in the luxuries and raw materials imported from the south of Europe. The consequences of these new commercial alignments, combined with a shortage of coin and general dislocation of the wool trade, was a swift and dramatic decline in the provincial fairs. London became more important. Fairs such as Winchester were reduced to insignificant, and only the fair at Westminster increased its income after 1300 due to its proximity to London. And all of this episode is just trying to tell a story and summarize simply. By 1300, London was in a unique position. It had become, by accident, the center of the English wool trade, the center of the English spice trade, the center of the trade in dyes. Sure, the wool was being collected from flocks everywhere else, but the big German and big Italian merchants were based in the city, and they dealt in large bulk orders, and they brought a lot of product there. This meant that London merchants in the city near them could capitalize on their desire to not go out and buy the stuff, and this increased the Londoners' wealth. As the Italians and Germans purchased this wool to export elsewhere, they financed this by importing a range of goods, most of which were luxury ones, and London became the utter focus of this trade, as it was the only market where there were rich enough customers to buy large amounts in any numbers. This then created a market that imported goods from spices to wax, and the London merchants had been helping the Italians and the Germans to get wool, now also helped them by buying some of this and making their own money selling it on around the country. Thus you start seeing the growth in the traditional dealers in spice, the pepperers, and also the rise in the newcomers, the ropers, where a bunch of London rope makers got all wide boy about things and basically diversified their interest. Because these ropers were based in a part of London called the Ropery, that region started to see lads making good and growing. In order to compete with the ropers' ties to the Germans next door, the pepperers up in Cheapside began to seek to relocate their trade to be nearer the ropers, and also near enough existing businesses on Cheapside. As one group moved southwards, the other group moved northwards, and they met on Soper's Lane. It became a thriving, busy, crowded street, filled with small, narrow shops. You could, as a Londoner, go in and purchase a tiny amount of wax, say, or someone from the Royal Court could walk into the same shop and order 100 weight for the King. The men who owned and ran these shops, they were Londoners. I mean, sure, many of them were migrants to the city, or the sons of migrants to the city. But remember, back then, foreigners began at the city walls. The term alien was used to describe everyone from someone being born in Great Yarmouth to someone being born in central Italy. It didn't matter. They were Londoners. They paid their taxes. They owned houses. They were landlords and businessmen. They became aldermen and sheriffs. They became mayors. This was London. This was Soper's Lane. In looking at the glory of Soper's Lane, its obscure beginnings, we get to see the story of what was really behind it. A change in London's fortunes. London entered the 14th century economically better suited than it had been since the 10th century. And while it's easy to look at the near 20 years of direct rule of the city by King Edward I as being what caused this, it really wasn't. It was a combination of circumstances, of luck, and decisions motivated by short-term needs that led London to finding itself entering, for the first time really, a position it would come to hold as time carried on. It was becoming the centre of distributional trade to the regional markets of England. It was the centre of importing and exporting goods to the continent, of foreign business. And this built upon its existing role of being traditionally the money pit of the land, the financial, monetary capital of the realm. And all of this became manifest in the property boom in Cheapside and down near Dowgate in the Ropery, and above all, in the crowded Soper's Lane, which had become a small beating heart of London's newfound power. And this was the base upon which the city would build. But I'll cover that next chapter. Thanks for listening. A bit of a meaty one on that, but I hope it held your interest. I'll be back again with another episode of The Story of London next week. Cheers. This is Saul saying bye.